Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, August 28, 2014, during a live telephone conference call.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the recent indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry. My name is Christian Corgan and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome Professor John S. Baker, Jr., visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and Professor Emeritus at Louisiana State University Law School. While Professor Baker is an authority on both separation of powers and criminal law, he's also a former state prosecutor in New Orleans. A more complete bio of Professor Baker was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. It should be noted that normally, as many of you know who join us frequently on these calls, that we do try to provide both sides, and in this case, we did attempt to find someone to provide a differing perspective on the issue than from Professor Baker's, but we were unable to do so. But we are very pleased to have Professor Baker with us today. And without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Professor Baker. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. As Christian indicated, we don't have another side today. And I think the reason for that is the public perception and professional perception that this is a, quote, partisan prosecution. I will nevertheless attempt to give a more balanced approach to this and, where possible, point out some things that might favor the other side. Doesn't mean that I agree with them, but I'd like to explore certain things. I use the word partisan deliberately, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But what I want to do is cover 3 points, and of course, because there's nobody else on the panel here, I get to speak longer, so that's nice. The first thing I want to talk about is the partisan and political nature of this prosecution. The second, I'll go into the legal issues raised by Governor Perry in his habeas corpus petition attempting to throw out the indictment. And third, I want to talk about a possible political response to prevent future abuses of prosecutorial power, exercise of power like this. So, first of all, on the point about the partisan and political nature of the prosecution, I think it's important to distinguish a couple of things. The word partisan, which I use deliberately, is not co-equal political. Political we often use in a sense as pejorative, and that's unfortunate because for the framers of the Constitution, politics is the art of self-government. We unfortunately have lost a lot of faith in politics. And when we label something political, it means somehow it is bad. There's a big difference, though. Politics, political, and police all derive from the same source, the polis, the word for the Greek city-states. It's about governing. In a sense, all prosecutions are, quote, political because they're meant to enforce the law and the understandings of that particular political organization. So political is not by itself bad. What's bad here is partisan political. And that has been the perception from the outset of the announcement of this indictment. That is attested to by the fact that prominent Democrats, Lanny Davis, Axelrod, Dershowitz, Professor Dershowitz, have all come out in response and condemning this indictment because of the perception that it is partisan, not just political, but partisan. Now, when we actually dig into this, the DA in question, the one whose prior conduct had prompted Governor Perry to veto the funds involved, she was, in fact, recused from the case. And apparently, the special prosecutor, Mr. McCrum, was appointed by a judge. And that is an important issue here because in charging that the case is political, it's not necessarily partisan, but it is political in another sense I want to talk about. McCrum, by all indication, based on an article in the Wall Street Journal, there's no evidence of partisanship on his part. He's a former federal prosecutor, and from all description and other comments about him, seems to be a fair-minded person. There is a different problem, however, and that is the mindset that one acquires as a federal prosecutor. Much of the time I spend writing is criticizing federal prosecutions. And why? Because historically, for a long period of time, federal criminal law has in fact twisted the criminal law from its common law roots. This particular prosecutor, and I believe most federal prosecutors, are fair-minded people who are simply doing the job they think they are supposed to do. My view has always been that much of the job they think they're supposed to do is not the job they're authorized to do. And a lot of this comes out in white-collar prosecution, and that's what this particular prosecutor did, in part as an assistant U.S. attorney. Here's what the problem for most federal prosecutors is. The part of the Constitution that they know happens to be located primarily in the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, which deal with the rights attendant to a criminal prosecution. Almost none of them are really familiar with separation of powers, and that's what this case is all about. The power of the governor as an independent branch in three branches of government to exercise his power. Lawyers, unfortunately, have been trained in law schools to, quote, as Justice Scalia says, love judges too much. And for many law-trained people, even if they're not liberal, many conservatives somehow prefer the approach of judging to the politics that our self-government requires. So I would say, first of all, it's important to distinguish that this prosecutor doesn't appear to be partisan, and however the attack ought to be, that he is bringing to it the mindset of a federal prosecutor. That leads me directly into the second issue, which has to do with the legal issues. Why? Because the particular statutes that he has used, he has interpreted in such a way and has stated facts in the indictment that are typical of the way that federal prosecutors do this. Now, this raises a whole series of issues. And I must commend Governor Perry's legal team, because at the outset, before getting into all of the specific charges and complaints they make against the indictment, they say quite clearly what is at stake. What is at stake is separation of powers. And then they go into an attack on each of the two counts. But let me talk a little bit about what those counts. Well, first of all, I'll go to the statutes themselves, and you can see just by my reading of the statutes, how they can possibly be manipulated. The first one is from Texas Penal Code Section 36.03A1. So the title of this is Coercion of Public Servant or Voter. A person commits an offense if by means of coercion. Coercion, that's the key on this one particular charge, coercion. He influences or attempts to influence a public servant, the DA was a public servant, in a specific exercise of his official power or a specific performance of his official duty, or influences or attempts to influence a public servant to violate the servant's known legal duty. Now, the argument is preposterous, except to a federal prosecutor. You can read the definition. I won't read all of the provisions in Section 1.07 of the Texas Penal Code. But it really doesn't fit into any of this unless you think that politicians are inherently corrupt and their exercise of legitimate constitutional power is somehow coercion. I'll come back to that later on and defend what he calls coercion in terms of exactly what the framers and the Federalists thought that people ought to be doing in occupying each of the branches of the federal government. The other statute has to do with the abuse of official capacity. A public servant commits an offense if, with intent to obtain a benefit or with intent to harm or defraud another, he intentionally misuses government property. They're claiming the governor used $200,000. Well, that was the amount vetoed. The governor didn't use it, but that is the kind of stretch that is typical in federal criminal indictments. Indeed, many federal criminal indictments only deal with, in fact, at most, ethical violations. Federal prosecutors are used to turning ethical violations into crimes, and that's exactly what this indictment does. That is why so many people have reacted by saying that this is a ridiculous indictment. Just briefly, I will hit some of the claims that the governor's legal team makes in response. As to count one, they have 9 charges about why the count is unconstitutional. I'll group them in a minute. As to count two, they have 12 charges as to why they are either unconstitutional or, in one case, violate a state statute. One of the things that often gets lost in criminal indictments or legal work generally in courts is what is most important. And that's why I said at the beginning that it was significant that the governor's team emphasized that this is really about separation of powers, because so many of the attacks are, in fact, involving other aspects. They involve separation of powers, but they also raise a number of other issues. Those issues, while important, are not nearly as important as the separation of powers issues. The only other set of issues that really come close are typical criminal law issues. That is to say, on both counts, there are attacks on the statute as being vague, and in the second case, vague and overbroad. We could go into a long discussion about vagueness and overbreadth. I'm happy to do that on the question period. Suffice it to say that rare is it that a state statute is declared vague on its face. It's usually vague as applied, and I would argue right here that it is vague as applied because the broad language as applied in the way the prosecutor did does not at all fit the language. Vague as a matter of law is also a charge made under Texas law. In other words, for every federal claim, constitutional claim, there is pretty much also a claim under the state constitution as to why it is a bad charge. As I mentioned, there are claims about separation of powers and veto. There are also interesting claims about the speech and debate clause, which the argument is made by the governor's team that he has, in vetoing, he is part of the legislative process and therefore is protected under the speech and debate clause. That'll be an interesting argument, and there is some Texas case law supporting it, but I don't consider it the most important argument. But good lawyers make every possible argument, and there is certainly a basis for it. Much has been made by some about the speech aspects of both issues, especially on the second count. There are speech issues here, but I think it's important not to lose sight of the fact that even though the governor made a statement about why he was vetoing, and that would be a normal routine thing in terms of telling somebody why you had vetoed the legislation, the idea that you could criminalize that kind of speech is obviously beyond what anyone would have ever thought was possible. And I think those are all good objections to it. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we ought not to think about this in terms so much of speech, but again, coming back to the basic question of separation of powers. Moving on briefly to what I've outlined as the third point, what do you do about problems of political power? It's an interesting one because that's what our Constitution is all about. And the framers of our Constitution in the Federalist explain that you can't really rely on a Bill of Rights. What you have to rely on is separation of powers and federalism. Why? Because you have to attach the ambition of the person to the office. They understood that what you wanted was to have each of the branches be a power that was in conflict with the other branches. And in their ambition to check the power of the other and to advance their own power, which is all very political, that that's where our real protection of liberty is to be found. Now, that strikes many people today as overly political. Well, if that's overly political, then people don't really want the kind of self-government that our Constitution provides. If we want government by judges, that's a totally different Constitution and one that increasingly we have been getting. How would one respond to this kind of situation? Well, I suggest this, not that it can be done in the governor's case, but afterwards, it's the way I think that is consistent with the thinking not only of the Federalists, but also the Anti-Federalists. That is to say, we have in the Sixth Amendment a provision that's called the vicinage provision. This has to do with where people are tried. One of the claims in the Declaration of Independence, one of the charges against the king was that he carried off people to be tried in England. And the point was that the colonists wanted, when charged, especially in political cases, to be tried by a jury of their peers in their own vicinage, in their own vicinity, that is. It's interesting that since Watergate, we've had this emphasis on, quote, ethics in government. And, of course, many of the ethics provisions in different states are anything but vehicles for promoting ethics. In this case, the so-called Public Integrity Unit was designed to deal with corruption. And someone like the special prosecutor might say, well, you know, federal prosecutors have gone after state officials for corruption because the state officials won't do it. And here now, I am acting in the capacity of a specially appointed state official, and we in Texas are going to go after corruption, and that's what we're going to do. It is good for Texas to go after corruption on its own rather than federal prosecutors, yes. But what is corruption? If you don't understand separation of powers, as clearly this special prosecutor does not, if he did, he would never have brought this indictment. Why? Because the very job of the governor is to protect against the legislature. As the Federalists said in Federalist 48, the body that you have to most protect against is the legislature, and that the executive is inherently weak, and the only weapon you can give the executive really is the veto power. So what this prosecutor is claiming is that the very tool for liberty is somehow criminal. This is so absurd that someone who is exercising this kind of power doesn't understand the basis of our liberty. Well, you can thank law schools for that, because it's not taught in law schools. So what can be done about this? Going back to the thought of the vicinage requirement, what is being charged is that the governor, who is exercising the veto on the behalf of his whole constituency, which is the state of Texas, not the city of Austin. This is a case where a grand jury in a Democratic stronghold in an otherwise conservative state can play politics. The only kind of political remedy to this situation in the future, it seems to me, would be something like changing the composition of the grand and the petit juries. That is to say, if you're going to charge a statewide official with statewide corruption, then let's have a statewide grand jury and a statewide petit jury, not just a Democratic grand jury from the city of Austin. This is consistent with the whole notion behind the Sixth Amendment, which is to give a fair and impartial jury among the people who are affected directly by the actions of the alleged defendant. Anyway, with that, I'll stop and open it up to questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that great presentation, Professor Baker. We'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. All right. Looks like we had one question jump on. We'll go right to it.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, calling from Austin, Texas. It seems there are several points here that might be addressed. One is the problem. A lot of people seem to have the impression or belief that a prosecutor's role is to first act as a judge before deciding whether or not to prosecute a case. In other words, to be impartial before making that decision. But I think that Mr. McCrum and most other prosecutors that I know imagine that their job as a prosecutor is to prosecute, and they're only concerned about whether they can get a conviction. They don't even care if the defendant is guilty or not, as long as the evidence is there to convict. The second point is the misuse, in my opinion, of the writ of habeas corpus in a situation where the defendant is not in custody as a general appeal mechanism. The appropriate measure would have been to file a writ of demurral before even entering a plea.
Comment. On the first one, first of all, I don't agree that most prosecutors act in the fashion that you're talking about. First of all, at the state level, certainly in big cities, prosecutors have all they can do to keep up with the murders, rapes, and robberies. They're generally not out fishing for additional business. They don't need it. I do agree that certainly prosecutors don't want to lose, and they're more likely to plea bargain tough cases, but it all depends on the character of the particular prosecutor. The problem at the federal level is, I think, a little bit different. I think that the prosecutors basically are well motivated, but like anything, you can get in a mindset where the other guy is always the bad guy, and you can presume people are guilty because you have certain information and without taking a detached position. I once debated this with the then head of the public integrity section of the Justice Department. And in response to my presentation, he got up and he said almost exactly these words, "Don't stop us from getting the bad guys." Well, yes, you're supposed to get the bad guys, but you're not supposed to make that judgment. You have to have probable cause, yes, but you're not the judge and jury. So I think it's a mixture. I think that people can be prosecutors too long, become cynical. I like the British system where a barrister is on both sides and not just on one side. So it's a mixed bag, and I think unless you've actually spent a lot of time down in the courts, you may come up with conclusions that don't match the reality.
All right. Well, we've got two questions pending, and our lines will be open. We'll go right to the first one right now.
Hi, this is Chris Green from the University of Mississippi. I'm curious about some of the state constitutional issues related to just the whole idea of indicting a governor rather than impeaching him. I know the issue was discussed a lot at the federal level in the 70s. Has anyone done a 50-state survey of, you know when governors or other executive officials can be indicted? I mean, I think there's structurally a really strong argument that it shouldn't be done locally, you know, just in Austin. But, you know, what constitutional provisions do different states have, I'm curious about.
Well, I don't know, but I do know this, that even though Texas has a provision on separation of powers, as do, I guess, most states, the reality is that the structure of the state governments don't adhere to the federal understanding of separation of powers. So, for instance, where you have elected attorneys general, you have the possibility and often the reality of conflict between the attorney general and the governor. They don't get along. They don't work together. Under federal separation of powers, the attorney general is an appointee of the president, and that's the way apparently in New Jersey. So I think when you have state constitutions that follow a different version of separation of powers, the question you raise is a very real one. And I don't know that states have thought about it because it hasn't been a common problem.
All right. Well, we'll move on to our next question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Baker, press star and then the pound key.
This is Linda Scladani. I'm a retired lawyer, and this question is a little different from the others, but it keeps bothering me. Is there any remote chance that the governor has a 1983 suit in this instance?
Well, it would be after the fact. I mean, it wouldn't be politic to bring it right now. And I don't know what his legal team is thinking. In the old days, it used to be when you were in state court and you didn't like the indictment, you'd run into federal court and seek an injunction on constitutional grounds. The Supreme Court barred that a number of years ago, effectively in most cases. So the norm is to let prosecutions be handled by the state and the state appellate process, and then afterwards deal with it by habeas corpus. Then there's a separate question of the federal civil rights action as to whether or not there has a basis for that is going to turn on questions of qualified immunity and near absolute prosecutorial immunity.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Baker, make a comment, press star and then the pound key. All right, we did have one question jump on the line.
John Rowland again. You didn't really answer my question about Murrell, but I have another one.
Okay, well, let me answer that first. I can't tell you about Texas procedure, but I do know in the jurisdictional part of the writ of the habeas corpus petition, the governor's lawyers make a distinction and say that if they do not prevail on the pretrial habeas petition, they will come back and raise factual issues by way of demurral.
Okay. The next thing is the problem that the statute provides for coercion of an official in the performance of his duties, but it seems that I have not heard anyone argue that clinging to office under pressure to resign constitutes performance of one's duties.
Again, I have to go back to the way federal prosecutors are very comfortable stretching language. I have actually litigated cases in which they have made much more absurd expansions, and oftentimes the federal courts uphold these.
All right, we had one more question jump on the line, and then we had two more questions jump on the line, so we'll go ahead and go to those.
Hi, this is Warren Belmar with a question as to timing. How long do you think it will take before this matter gets addressed by the judge, and how long might it last at the trial court level before moving on?
Well, first of all, there has to be time for the prosecutor to respond. So I would imagine it would be before 30 days from the filing of the petition. That would be the earliest. Beyond that, it depends on the judge. I don't know anything about this judge. Some judges dispatch their work very quickly. Others sit on it for a long time. If there's going to be a written opinion, which I assume there would be, unless it's some very short dismissal of all the arguments on a procedural ground that is not a proper motion, then, as I mentioned, there are 9 and 12 allegations total, so that's 21 allegations. If the judge is going to write an opinion, which he or she, I don't know which it is, will likely do, knowing that the media is going to scrutinize it, I don't know how comfortable the district judge is in writing that kind of opinion. He And the judge is going to want to take a lot of care writing that opinion. That may take a while.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you'd like to get in line, ask and ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Society member in Berkeley, California. Thank you for your comments. A question for you that I don't think has been discussed is that in reference to the statute and the coercion of the public official, I mean, this is a case where it's a public official allegedly coercing another public official. But in the case of Governor Perry, he is also subject to impeachment, and he's also subject to being voted out of office. So those seem to be kind of independent ways of remedying the kind of action that might be an underlying concern of the statute. And I'd like to get your thoughts on whether, at least as far as the legal arguments go, the impeachment alternative is something that's worth discussing relative to the merits of the statute on its own face.
Well, if you look at it in purely partisan terms, I mean, the Democrats in Austin who want to attack the governor know that the Republican legislature is not going to do anything to impeach him. So if you're looking at those terms and you don't care about anything else, strategically you would say, well, maybe this is a possibility. Fortunately, I think it's backfired on them. But in terms of whether or not that should affect the judge's ruling, it should in this sense, in the sense that it's a separation of powers issue. This is not a matter the judiciary should get into. It should be a political fight between the two branches, or if somebody else wants to get involved, through the legislative branch. But again, lawyers have been educated to love judges so much that they think that they can get any kind of remedy they want, often, out of a judge. Why not try, is often the attitude.
All right, well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then the pound key. All right, we just had another one jump on, so we'll go right to that.
Professor Baker, this is Al Agricola in Montgomery, Alabama. Is there available a pretrial appeal to the Texas Supreme Court for Governor Perry in the event that his motions in the trial court are denied?
I don't know. That's a question I have, and I don't have an answer to it. And if they didn't, then the question would be, do they file a mandamus in order, let's say the trial judge doesn't rule on it at all, or he rules in a way that says, no, this is not a proper motion. That might go by mandamus. In fact, in 2001, in a case called In Re Perry, where there was an attempt to depose the governor and the attorney general, and the appellate court had held that there could be a deposition, they went up on mandamus, and the Texas Supreme Court said that it was an improper move because there was protection under the speech and debate clause. I mentioned briefly speech and debate clause under Texas law, and that's one of the cases that the legal team is citing in defense, or in the argument that what the governor did was protected by the speech and debate clause.
All right, our lines are open, so star and then the pound key if you'd like to take one last chance to ask a question. All right, we just got one more question on the line. We'll go right to it.
Professor Baker, this is Daniel Ogden, Dallas, Texas. I'm wondering if you could comment on what you think this particular case portends for over the long term, and particularly the tendency to have a criminalization of politics. I know that's something that's been discussed a lot. I'm wondering if you think that that this case does reflect that trend, and how you might see that, if so, that trend going in the future.
Well, absolutely. I think it relates to several things that I talked about. I think there is a notion that we can't trust politics, and we think somehow that courts can solve all these matters. There's a tendency worldwide to judicialize everything. The whole war on terror is by some people, they're trying to move it to judicialize warfare. They want to get rid of, quote, violence everywhere and violence in politics. There's this notion that somehow, as others have said, Platonic guardians will protect us. Well, Madison and Federalist Ted said, look, it doesn't work that way. We can't have outsiders protecting us. The political system has to be so structured in such a way that it not only governs, but it governs itself. And so politically, we do believe that we can govern ourselves or we don't. Increasingly, not only at the state level, but certainly at the federal level, members of Congress don't want to do anything responsible. They want somebody else to do it. And all of that is kind of an abdication of the political process. As we do that, we look more and more to courts. As we look more and more to courts, we have been criminalizing everything since the 1970s. A lot of this driven by Republicans, by the way, both at the state and the federal level. Some Republicans, however, have now understood that we've gone too far. I know there are groups in Texas, the Texas State Policy Group, and others who are trying to get states to cut back on overcriminalization. When you give too much discretion by way of badly drafted statutes, you leave open the possibility that prosecutors will abuse them. And I think that's what's happening here, and increasingly I think it will happen. The encouraging thing is that there is a bipartisan reaction to this indictment. And also in the House of Representatives, there is a bipartisan reaction to over-federalization of crime. So maybe we've realized that we've gone too far in criminalizing things. At least I hope so.
All right. Well, our lines are open. So we'll make a last call for questions, star, and then the pound key, if you'd like to get on and ask Professor Baker a question or make a comment. Well, Professor Baker, did you have anything that you touched on earlier or any – oh, we did get one more. We did get one more question.
And John Rowland again. You didn't really address my question about whether clinging to office is performance of the duties of an office that could be subject to coercion.
Clinging to office. I mean
– In other words, performance of the duties of an office, of, say, a prosecutor, a DA, would be to prosecute one guy or to prosecute a different guy or not prosecute someone else or do it in one way and not in another way, but simply refusing to resign does not seem to me to fall under the heading of performance of the duties of one's office. Therefore, well, you can't really coerce somebody on that.
Sure. I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I think the focus is the word coercion. But sure, throw that in.
Well, Professor Baker, while we're waiting for here we go, one more question.
Professor Baker, this is Al Agricola again. If this conduct on the part of the governor in the exercise of his constitutional duty or obligation to veto legislation can be interpreted as coercion of a public official, Couldn't any veto become coercion of the public official that might be directly affected by the veto?
Sure, of course. I mean, the word coercion can be obviously misused. And in state criminal law, unlike federal criminal law, there's usually common sense interpretation of the ordinary uses of words. And this is a case in which, as I said, we have a former federal prosecutor who's used to misusing words and doesn't think anything is wrong with that, doing so in this case. It's a misuse of words. But unfortunately, in law school, that's what many people are taught, the abuse of words. And we don't pay enough attention to the common, ordinary meaning of words and restricting it. Lawyers are constantly trying to expand the use of words if it suits their purpose.
All right, our lines are still open. So star and then the pound key. All right, one more question on the line.
Hi, this is John Eidsmo with the Foundation for Moral Law in Montgomery, Alabama, just a few doors away from Al Agricola. But my observation is that, in general, the grand jury, as I see it, was intended to be almost like a third branch of, or a fourth branch of government, or a people's check on particularly executive power. And that in practice, it seems like the grand jury has generally become just kind of like a tool of the prosecutor. It does pretty well what the prosecutor suggests that they do. And I'm wondering if Professor Baker would agree with that and if he sees any ways that we could revitalize this institution.
Good question. Historically, the grand jury originally was to have people in the community who inform the government about what crimes were occurring in the community. So its original purpose was not as you describe it. Later on, certainly at the time of the founding, it was viewed as a protection. I think most people who practice criminal law today understand that a grand jury is pretty much the tool of the prosecutor. And while at federal, you have to have a grand jury for just about everything, it varies from state to state. Most criminal, most jurisdictions would break down if they had to go to a grand jury for everything. So it's depending on the state, it's the major crimes, murder, et cetera. Because unlike the federal system, you don't have that many conspiracy cases. In the federal system, grand juries are often long-term investigating grand juries that are calling people over a long period of time and building a case. And it's only really the prosecutor in there, and the proceedings are secret and can't be divulged. And sometimes the defendant is sometimes invited to appear. Most lawyers would say don't do it because it's a trap for being set up for a perjury prosecution. So there's a whole area of grand jury practice, and is it subject to abuse? Sure. And I think too many people put too much weight when the notion that a grand jury has come up with an indictment. They think that somehow this is a balanced process. It's not. And I'm not impugning the grand jurors. It is, I think, the point that you're making, that they receive only really what the prosecutor wants them to hear or see. This is not always the case. I actually was called one time as an expert before a grand jury to help the grand jury understand the law. And I think, again, I think that grand jurors, in my experience, are people who want to do a good job, and I don't think they want to be the tool of the prosecutor. The question is, though, is their access to information so shaped that the result they're going to come to is almost always what the prosecutor wants? sometimes, especially local prosecutors in a hot political case where they're being pressed to indict or not indict, will put the case before a grand jury and let the grand jury, quote, decide, and then can announce, well, the grand jury decided to do this or not to do this, and that way the prosecutor attempts to minimize his or her accountability.
All right, our lines are open. We've got enough time to do a few more questions. So star and then the pound key if you'd like to get on and make a question or a comment.
This is Paul Larkin from the Heritage Foundation. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
I just wanted to comment on what the professor in the last commenter said. I actually sat on a state grand jury in Alexandria, and the only reason we didn't indict a ham sandwich was no one asked. We returned 85 indictments in one day. Each one of them was based just on the testimony of the police officer. And I remember every time I wanted to ask a question, the foreman would always say, I'm ready to vote. So I think in many of the states, and probably even in many of the federal cases, the grand jury does really do exactly what the prosecutor wants it to do, or the police officer wants it to do. My experience with the state grand jury in Alexandria certainly persuaded me of that. The federal government will never give up the ability to use the grand jury, because to make white-collar cases, you need documents, and you have to get grand jury subpoenas to get the documents. So the federal government will never change that. I doubt the states will either, for the reason that the professor mentioned at the end. There are times it's best to let the grand jury return a no true bill so that it can bear whatever responsibility there is for that decision rather than the prosecutor, because otherwise the prosecutors would charge people because they'd be afraid to return the call by not returning anything. So I think there are a great many instances in which what was once a valuable institution now has become essentially, at best, a complete waste of time.
Paul, let me ask you, do you know in Virginia, since you were returning 85 indictments in one day, they had to be, they couldn't all be very serious crimes. So Virginia must then require a grand jury for all kinds of crimes.
Well, let me say, they were, by and large, felonies, but they were not complex felonies. I mean, in many instances, what they were hand-to-hand transactions involving crack cocaine. So after you've heard the 30th report by a police officer about how he observed the sale of crack cocaine, you can almost fill in the rest of what his testimony is going to be.
Right. Those are
serious because they're felonies, but they're not factually complicated.
Well, no, but it's not just factually complicated. You know, in some states, if it's going to be a murder indictment, it's going to have to come from the grand jury. So it goes on the basis of the penalty, not on the base, I mean, the type of the crime. It's only certain crimes. The reason it would have to be routine there is simply because of the number of cases you're going to have. In other states, you would just indict that. I mean, it would be a bill of information. It wouldn't be an indictment. And so that bill of information would charge it, and you wouldn't have to take the grand jury's time. You know, that's a case where supposedly the grand jury is protecting people, but as you say, it's not. It's doing what an assistant DA would routinely do, and so they reduce the grand jury to routinely doing what one person would otherwise do in another state. And that's how you waste resources and time and everything else.
All right, well, we have two questions pending, which we should be able to get to in about 10 minutes left. So just a note, if you would like to ask a question to Professor Baker, make sure and press star and the pound key.
John Rowland again. Perhaps we could get into proposals for reform of the grand jury system. And there's an interesting historical note on that here in Austin. In Texas, each county has the option of either selecting grand jurors from a list of volunteers or at random, away trial juries are selected. And a few years ago, a citizen had a complaint about an ethics violation, or really an open meetings violation, by state officials that he wanted to take to the grand jury directly in Travis County. And the Travis County DA would not let him bring his case to the grand jury. So he went to a local judge, Charlie Baird, who ordered that the grand jury be open to him to present his evidence, and as a result of which reforms were made. So that judge, Charlie Baird, was also the opponent of Rosemary Lemberg in the last election. So there is the grand jury has been the focus of a lot of debate here in Texas, and it's becoming an increasing area of concern.
Well, the other thing that some grand juries do occasionally is issue reports without an indictment that can be damning, and I don't see that function of the grand jury serves any purpose today.
All right. Well, we have one more question pending, and then after that, we probably have time to get to one or two more after that. So we'll make this a last call. If you'd like to get on the line and ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, this is Christopher Holloman. I served on a grand jury in Arlington, Virginia, and had an almost identical experience to the gentleman in Alexandria. One of the things that struck me about that grand jury when we were charged by the judges, he admonished us that we were not chosen at random. We were chosen because we were known to be solid citizens of some kind, which I gather meant that we were all known to the authorities in some way or other to be people who would be likely to vote to indict. A good Federalist that I was the liberal on that grand jury. Those people would have indicted their own grandchildren. But leave that aside. I'm afraid I came in a little late. Is there really an argument for this indictment of Governor Perry?
Well, I went through and talked about how someone who is a former federal prosecutor would, viewing it the way federal prosecutors view the world and their statutes, would be able in his own mind to conceive this as an indictable offense. But you can listen to that on the podcast.
Okay. Yes, to echo what Professor Baker said, this is Christian Corgan. We will be posting this, just like all of our other podcasts or all of our other teleforms, as a podcast on our website within the next couple of days. You can always go back and re-listen to Professor Baker's presentation, and that'll be posted on our website. Well, we do have another question on the line that we've got time to get to. We'll go right to that.
Yes, my name's Bill Pomerantz, and I just finished spending 5 weeks in grand jury duty, but in the District of Columbia, which is run basically by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and my experience is totally the opposite. I actually acted as the foreman. I gave everybody ample opportunity to ask all the questions that they wanted, both of the witnesses and while we were doing our discussion. So maybe it's just got to do with the area.
Well, it has to do with federalism, and there should be differences from place to place. And what's needed is that the public in each place ought to understand better what's going on in their jurisdiction as opposed to what's going on in others. It's quite common in a state. You can go from one county to the next, and there are huge differences in how the law is enforced. And again, that goes back to the political element. We have not only 50 states, but we have different counties, and each county is, quote, each political area is political. And it's that body politic that's supposed to influence the police and the prosecutors on how they shape the law, how they enforce it. So I'm glad you had a good experience. I think that most people, in my experience in the past, certainly in state courts, is that it's a good experience to serve on a jury.
All All right. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left, so we'll go ahead and make this the official last call for any questions. Star and then the pound key. Well, Professor Baker, since we've got a couple minutes left, I'll just give you an opportunity. Is there anything that was discussed earlier, any further points that you'd like to make before we conclude the call?
No, thank you, Christian. I've said more than enough.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our expert, Professor Baker, for being with us today. Thank you to our audience for listening, for your very interesting questions and comments. We welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please continue to check our website for this podcast as well as all of our other podcasts from other Teleform conference calls, and we look forward to having you join us again in the future. So thank you all very much, and until next time, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.